Hey everyone, I'm Adrian Wojnarowski, host of the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by Digital Media, here in our New York studio today with Milwaukee Bucks General Manager John Hammond, the 2010 Executive of the Year, an Assistant General Manager under Joe Dumars, helping to put together those great Detroit Piston teams in the 2000s that won a championship, got to another finals, and reached the Eastern Conference Finals six straight times. And really one of the respected executives in the league who's done almost every job in basketball at every level. So let's get to our visit with Milwaukee Bucks GM John Hammond. Here in our New York studio with Milwaukee Bucks GM John Hammond. John, welcome in.
Thanks, Adrian. Great to be here with you.
John's in town with the Bucks. They play the Knicks. It's rare that we're taping on the same day that the podcast will be published, but play the Knicks at the Garden. Here's a question for you, John, as a GM. How do you decide when is the right time to travel with the team? When should you be out scouting? You do most of your scouting, I know as a staff, you plan it out over the course of a season. But how do you balance as a GM? Should I be with the team? Should I be off seeing college games or in the office? Is that one of the toughest decisions you have year to year? Where should I be?
No, it's an easy decision. It's, you go with the team to support the team, to get a little pulse of the team, but you also use that as scouting opportunities. You know, when do you get a chance to see other teams in the NBA? Well, you watch them against your own team, so you're doing two things. You're there for your own team, and you use it as a scouting opportunity to see the league. But, you know, for someone like myself, Adrian, I kind of, you know, maybe, I don't know, travel with the team 50, 60% of the time, probably a little more than half maybe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's really the other scouting side that comes along with it in the team building, and that is to kind of say, like, what's going on in the draft? And so if I'm not with the team, I'm going to be on the road scouting a college game or maybe in Europe or wherever it might be, but it's going to be a part of scouting. So I'm never home when our team is playing. If our team is playing, I'm either with them or on the road scouting.
If I would have told you in the preseason, John, when Chris Middleton goes down, at this point, 17-16, middle of the pack in the Eastern Conference, you would have taken it?
Oh, all day long. No doubt whatsoever. Yeah, you know, I'm really proud of our players, proud of our coaching staff. Everyone's working extremely hard, and guys are improving, and our team's getting better.
Having a team with having Giannis, Jabari Parker, having young star, burgeoning star players in the league that, as a GM, you know, this is who we're building around. That every decision you make now, so many times in this league, you know, when you have really good young players, you're trying to figure out, are they cornerstone guys? Are we really going to build around them? Are they good enough? And a lot of teams are always asking that question. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. I know you're not asking that question. You know these guys are good enough. I think you know what you have here. It just changed. I just imagine it must change the whole mindset of now how you put a team together and the pieces around them, because you just know for the next 10 years or 15 years, we hope, those are our cornerstone guys.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point, and I think that is kind of how you look at it. And then, you know, so many people will say now, well, you know, if you can just get the right players, the right pieces to go around those guys, and it is that. And I think, you know, we're all going to continue to build towards something like that. But look, there's also, you know, the need for, if you think you have those kind of players, that they need to continue to improve. And so it's constantly, I think, you know, building from within, first and foremost. And then, you see what else you can do with your roster to put the right kind of players around them. But, you know, I think for who we are, I think we've got to be really careful, even at this young stage, to not, you know, go too deep into that. That is just about those guys. Even though we do think they are special players, it's got to be about the team and it's got to be about the organization first.
You signed a contract last year that takes you through 2018, which would put you at 10 years in Milwaukee. You came in 2008 from Detroit. Justin Zanuck, you helped hire Justin Zanuck from Utah, who will replace you whenever you step away as GM. When you make decisions now, knowing that many will be legacy decisions for you, you may not be in this position when a lot of these decisions, really, the fruits of them, that these guys are in their prime or another young player you draft becomes, you know, a really good player. Does it change your view of things as you're doing the job now, knowing that there's sort of an end date here? As for now, there's an end date in 2018. How does it change, or how does it make you approach a job any differently?
You know, it's interesting working in, I think in any business that you're in, and in sport in particular, you know, when you're having success and you do see a future and you do see potential future success and something that you get excited about, you know, when you talk about something like that, about a legacy, you think you don't want the legacy to end. You think, man, we got a chance to have some real fun here in the future and to maybe be a part of a special group. So, you know, you do your job to the best of your ability and things will play themselves out accordingly.
Listen, you've accomplished a lot in your basketball career. You've coached, you've been in the front office. You won a championship with Joe Dumars as part of his staff in Detroit. And if someone, when they think back to John Hammond, if they remember that you were the guy in a draft where no one knew what to make of the Greek freak who went over to Greece and saw him in a dingy gym with your own eyes beyond the grainy tape that a lot of other people had, are there nights where you're watching your team going, this kid's so good, they may remember me for having brought this kid to Milwaukee? You imagine that's plausible?
I don't know. I think people are talking about him in those terms, and what he's doing today is pretty special. There's no doubt whatsoever. You know, Joe Dumars used to say to me all the time, I love how he would say it. He'd say, you know, Mr. John, it's one thing. It's one thing to become a great player. It's another thing to maintain greatness and have the longevity of greatness. So many things are a part of that, the health of the player, the player continuing to improve, that he doesn't change, that he stays within who and what he is and what's made him to this point. But, you know, it's fun. I work with Rod Thorne now. You know, Rod works this in our organization. And, you know, Rod's always the guy that, you know, drafted Michael. And Rod's done so many other things mm-hmm. in his career, along with that, obviously, legacy that he has. But that's one thing, that he's the guy, you know, that drafted Michael. So I don't know if that's ever going to be the case, but, you know, I guess would be lucky if that, you know, something like that did happen. You were attached to a player like that. But, you know, that's a lot to put on a young guy like Giannis. That's, you know, we just hope he continues to improve and, you know, gets better and better.
When you got on a plane to go over and scout Giannis in Greece, what was your expectation of what you were going to see, and how zeroed in were you on him before you walked in the gym at that spot?
Look, I'm not going to make this thing any more than what it really was. And as a general manager, I've got, you know, really good guys that you're working with and people that you enjoy being around. And, you know, the top of the list at that time was Jeff Weltman with me. You know, Jeff was the assistant GM. Obviously, Jeff's a GM in Toronto now, but you know, it was Jeff walking into my office and saying, hey, there's a, you know, I think we should make a trip. We need to go over to Greece and see this player. He's getting a lot of attention. And that was really the start of it. And we went together, as a matter of fact. Jeff and I went together and, you know, we sat down in that gym and it didn't take us long to realize that this guy had a chance to be a good player. You know, I wish I could say that, you know, he and I both saw something that no one else saw. You know, look, the league knew about him. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he was on people's radar. And it's, you know, it's just a part of the due diligence of doing your job. And we were fortunate enough to be able to draft him. And he's turned out to be who he is today. And we hope he can continue to get better and better.
The maneuvering on draft night for him. Toronto was trying to get up to get at him. Atlanta really wanted him. You know, other people, listen, a lot of people liked him. Then it's a question of how much am I willing to give up to move up. So, you know, anybody could have gotten up if they could have given up. What do you remember about that night of thinking, do we have to jump up to get him? Or are we going to be okay where we were? And what are the guys behind us doing? What do you remember about sort of your fact finding on draft night when you did select him?
Well, the only thing I will say is, once again, not making anything more of it than it really was, that we had our draft order at 15 and he was the first guy on our list. And then we had our second option or third player or fourth player. So we went probably like four deep, but you know, he was the first guy on our list. And I think we felt pretty comfortable that he was going to be there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Adrian, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to sit here and say, man, we were just like, you know, so nervous because we knew he was going to be a franchise type player, and and it was going to be a defining moment for this, you know, potentially for our organization. That wasn't the case. It was the case of like, we thought he had a chance to be a good player. We, you know, we really liked what we saw. You know, here's this, you know, the length, his ability to see the floor. He's like, he knew how to play. All those sort of things were right there. But, you know, I'm not going to go there and say that it was something more than it really was on that draft night. We worked out great for us.
It kind of gets back to this little bit, and you and I have talked about this in the past. Luck. There's just how much of this business and how much of things that go great for you or things that don't go great, that there's the variables of, you know, like you would talk with R.C. Buford about Ginobili, and people want to give him great credit for drafting Ginobili at 57th. He said, listen, if I thought he was that good, we had three picks in front of him that year. Like, we didn't think he was anything. We had the pick. I saw him play in South America, and we use it on him. I didn't think he was anything special. Like, we got lucky. And I think when you've been doing it as long as you have, right, that you sort of look at it and go, you know, there's a few that have gone against me where we thought we were in position to do something great, and there was an injury, there was something, and then here's one where it's gone in our favor, that this is the business, right? This is good fortune plays a part in it.
Yeah, it does, you know, and it's the good fortune of, think of, you know, sometimes the right player for the right team, the right fit. The draft is tough, man. It's you talk about inexact science, and we're doing everything we can to put as much science into it as we can, from analytics to psychological profiling to the background work we do to everything that every other team is doing as well. And we're trying to get it right, but so many times it's you look at a guy like Giannis and say he was drafted by our organization. I think would turn out to be a really good fit for he and his family and so many other things. And then also, you know, that year, you look at the year we drafted Giannis, no one expected us to win 15 games. You know, we were who we had been, and that was kind of the mandate at that time, was let's be the best team we can be. And, you know, we're projected that, I think if you looked at the preseason projections, you'd say, well, if Milwaukee stays healthy, they may be able to sneak into the playoffs. Maybe they can get into that 8th seed. And then all heck broke loose for us, had a rash of injuries, and we got to the point where here we've got this young guy on our team that we thought had this kind of ability, and Larry Drew was the coach at the time, and he put him out on the floor, and he got an opportunity to develop, you know. And that's important. That was really critical for Giannis to get that opportunity as a rookie to be able to play. And sometimes that doesn't happen for guys. You look at a guy like Thon Maker right now. We love Thon, and we think he has a chance to be a really good player down the line. But, you know, hopefully things continue to go well for us. And that opportunity may not be there for Thon this year to be on the floor like Giannis was. So many things just fit into the Ginobili stories, whoever it might be, man. Right fit, right player, right place.
And you end up this year with a second-round pick in Malcolm Brogdon, who's a rotation player, has a triple-double, you know, as productive. There's only a couple rookies more productive night in and night out. And so usually you'd think, okay, the lottery picks the guy who's playing a little bit, and the second-round picks a developmental player. And your second-round pick was more ready to play. And that's just how it goes sometimes. And somebody'd say, well, we're just not going to get much out of the draft this year because we know Thon Maker is a long-term thing. And here comes Brogdon stepping right in and contributing.
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, once again, if you – you look at that, you say, well, boy, you'd take, you know, Malcolm earlier than you did at that point in the draft. But yeah, he, you know, once again, there it is, the great example. Right player, right fit, right team.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
John, we'll get back to our conversation in a moment, but I've got to ask my listeners a question. If you could get three home-cooked meals for free, would you sign up for it? Well, of course you would. Well, all you've got to do is remember my name, Woj, W-O-J. Now keep listening, and I'll tell you how to get those free meals. We all know there's nothing better than a great home-cooked meal, and no one makes it easier for you to do that than Blue Apron. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their suppliers and only bring you the best ingredients, all right to your door. Plus, each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Now listen closely because this is the part about the three free meals I was just telling you about. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/woj. Think about that. That's three meals free just by typing in my name. Once again, that's blueapron.com/woj. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And now back to our guest, John Hammond. John, when you look back, who taught you how to scout? When you think about scouting and the things that are important to you and that you look for and that you sort of organize yourself with, where did you learn the most about it?
You know, I've been doing it my whole life, my whole working life, with exception. You know, I started as a high school coach for 3 years, and I got my first college opportunity when I was 25 years old, and I'm 62 now. I hate to say that, but 62, and that's all I've done. I've been evaluating players since that day in my life, and at just different levels. But there's similarities, you know. That I remember years ago, I was sitting with Kip Mata, the son of Dick Mata, great NBA coach, and I remember him saying to Kip and I at one point, sitting at some kind of event, and he goes, "You know, guys, the game is always the game." He goes, "It doesn't matter what level you're at, junior high, high school, college, or pro, and it doesn't matter whether it's men or women, the game is still the game." And I've always thought about that. I think there's a lot of truth to that, you know. So, you know, whether you're evaluating players at the college level or evaluating players for the NBA level, I think there's still that part of it. It's just the evaluation process. And I don't know, you talk about, like, you know, getting them right. I think that, you know, going back to Jeff Weltman, you know, his dad, Harry Weltman, was a great basketball man and was a GM in the ABA and NBA. And I remember him saying, I don't know if he said it to us or Jeff said it to me, you know, my dad used to say all the time that you don't get them right. You know, you're going to get a lot wrong. All you're trying to do is get one more right than your opponent.
Right.
And so, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, think of all those years I've been doing it, have got a whole lot wrong. And, you know, every once in a while you get one right. And if you get one right, man, you feel really excited about that.
Your years with Joe Dumars in Detroit, two trips to the NBA Finals and NBA Championship, six straight trips to the Eastern Conference Finals, a team that was built in a way that I don't know if we'll ever see a championship team built again, the way you built that team. What did that experience in Detroit teach you about team building? About, it was an unconventional, you won without what we would, any of us would consider a true superstar. If there is a Hall of Famer on that team, it's, you know, if Chauncey Billups is a Hall of Famer, people may have to argue it. Chauncey and I told Chauncey, to me, his comparison as a Hall of Famer is Ken Stabler. Like, not the biggest stats guy, but a winning player on really good teams. And then, you know, Stabler went to Houston and helped them win, and Chauncey went to Denver. Like, that's, to me, is like his case was outside basketball more, but just not your, there's no LeBron James, there's no Kobe Bryant. I would imagine you even have a greater appreciation looking back at that era now than maybe even did during it.
There's no doubt whatsoever. And, you know, that team was an anomaly. I really believe that. And if you look, I mean, think about this, Adrian. Go back to the team that won it last year and the year before that and the year before that. And then go back even, like, I don't know how many years you would do it, maybe 25, 30 years. Every team that's won a championship has had a Hall of Fame player. And you can still say, well, how do you know they're going to be Hall of Fame players? We know over like last year's team, they have a Hall of Fame player, that mm-hmm. championship team. And the team the year before that, that guy, one of those guys, maybe two of those guys have a chance to be a Hall of Fame player. So, right. You know, the difference, you're right.
Difference, and the case maybe too, the reason any of those guys might be a Hall of Fame player is because they won a championship in Detroit and won a lot in Detroit. That's why they become a Hall. That's why they're a Hall of Fame player, not as an individual.
That's correct. Yeah. And that's the thing about our team. You know, you can, I've done it. I've looked, you know, the teams 25 years before and after then we, you know, won the championship. Beyond that, there's always had that one guy. That guy's locked in, penciled in Hall of Famer is going to be. And that's the one thing with our team. We just didn't have that guy. And that's not taking anything away from Chauncey Billups or not taking anything away from Ben Wallace, as magnificent as he was, leading the league in rebounding, block shots, defensive player of the year. And those kind of guys could be in that conversation. There's no doubt. But when that team was winning it, we weren't that. And it was just a, you know, give Joe an awful lot of credit for what happened there. I, you know, as I said, like go back and find it before and find it after. It's not there. You know, it was just the right fit with the right guys and, you know, the whole scenario for, you know, talking about Giannis or any of these type of the guys, you know, when you get those players that, you know, you trade for a guy or you draft a guy, you know, when you're talking about that guy that you're saying he's even better than I thought, you know, then you've got something going. And that kind of happened with our team. All those guys turned out to be even better than we thought they were. And next thing you know, they're playing in two finals, won a championship and had a chance to win more. But it was a great run. And, you know, I think that team, it fit as a team. You think about leadership. Leadership's important during that time. And Joe Dumars deserves a lot of credit for the leadership over those years, because we had some coaches kind of come and go during that time, but the one stable factor during that time was Joe Dumars. And I think guys like Chauncey and Ben and Sheed and all those guys would tell you the same.
Rasheed was the final piece to the championship. It was an in-season trade. What was, when you think back to the discussions, the deals you made there, all the decisions that led to putting the other championship team, what do you remember was the one that you and Joe or that you guys maybe labored over the most? Like when you think of like the moment where you kind of took a deep breath and said, all right, we're going to do this and maybe there's great risk to it. You did the Richard Hamilton deal with Stackhouse with Washington. What decision-making process in that whole time where you look back on it and say, boy, we really labored over that one?
Well, you know, and you bring up the Rip trade. That's interesting. You know, you think about that team the year before made a comeback and had a 50-win season. I think the year before, I think that maybe won 34 games and come back and had a 50-win season. And Jerry Stackhouse was playing great on that team. I'm averaging maybe 23 points a game, whatever it was. And I can remember being in the Palace and our crowds are growing and getting back to where they were. I can remember the crowds yelling, Jerry, 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 he's having those big nights. And all of a sudden, opportunity presents itself to trade that guy. And I think that was a really, really tough decision. But, you know, I once again kind of give Joe the credit saying of like, okay, you look at as we're moving forward with the team and the fit of who we're going to be and trying to find it, make it about just the team. And that's not taking anything away from Jerry and his career. And, you know, man, I'm proud of him and what he's doing. He's a good friend of mine today and, you know, coaching the D-League team in Toronto. And the guy's amazing, you know. But I think that was interesting. That was, like, to me, like the first step. That was the first step of kind of like the building process was that Jerry trade. And it's interesting that I probably wouldn't have said that until you brought it up, Adrian, but I think it really was. And then, you know, obviously the Sheed trade was probably the next factor in that, just kind of like, here we have this team and we're a 50-win team. We're there. We're knocking on the door, but we need one more player. As has happened so many times, you hear those stories. And for Sheed, that was a great opportunity for
us. And you think of Luck, and I think this might have been prior to you joining them, the sign and trade with Grant Hill that brought, at the time it felt like, as an organization, we've got this great young superstar and we can't keep him. Grant Hill's leaving. Okay, we'll do a sign and trade. What can we get for him? All right. Chucky Atkins and Ben Wallace. And Ben Wallace had everybody had a chance to sign him. He'd bounced around and, all right, we'll just get something for him. And then you look back and you go, well, you know, Grant, you know, has the injuries and doesn't, you know, Atkins became a good player and Ben Wallace became a cornerstone player and kind of gets back a little bit of luck.
No doubt. You know, you think you're going to lose a player like Grant Hill. You can't survive that as an organization. And I thought that was, you're right, you look back on that and say for Joe to be able to acquire Ben Wallace and Chucky Atkins in a sign and trade with Grant, that might have been the very first step of the whole thing. But, you know, I think, you know, Joe would be, if he were sitting here with us right now, he'd say, hey, look, I had no idea Ben Wallace is going to be Ben Wallace. But, you know, once again, the guy, you know, turned out to be so much better than we thought and so much better than Joe thought at the time. I wasn't there, but man, what a great career he had. And it's interesting, you think about that. You know, that sign and trade, when Joe made that, and you're talking today, and we just mentioned, like, well, maybe Ben Wallace, maybe Hall of Fame. That's pretty amazing.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by digital media. Find your voice.
John, sit tight for a moment so I can tell my listeners about SeatGeek. Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a very confusing process for a long time. It's always been hard to find the best deal for that game or show you want to go to, but SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that make it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets, and it's pretty neat how they do it too. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and you never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and they'll let you know if the ticket prices fall. And even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone, and I use it all the time because it's simple and it works. And best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. They show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to trick you with big fees on the checkout page. Now listen closely to this next part because it's real important. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's $20 right into your pocket. And to get it, all you've got to do is this. Download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, then enter promo code WOJ, W-O-J. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. It does not get any easier than that. So please support SeatGeek the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code WOJ today. And now back to our guest, Milwaukee Bucks General Manager John Hammond. John, you had been, by the time you got into Detroit with Joe Dumars, you had been an assistant at the previous job. You had been at Missouri with Quinn Snyder as an assistant, and you had gotten to know Quinn with the Clippers. You had been an assistant with Larry Brown. You'd all worked under Don Sterling. I imagine you get this question all the time from people. They come up to you, how do I become a GM? I want to be a GM someday. How do I become it? I guess any of us get it in your line of work. And for me, like, the path that I took, small newspaper covering high schools to a little bigger newspaper to a little bigger newspaper, I'm not sure that path exists anymore. Your path, teaching driver's ed in high school gym class in Nebraska, I don't know if there'll be another driver's ed teacher who becomes a GM, right? Yeah. Or who is going to take the path you did. I would imagine when you were a kid in Nebraska, and you got a big break to go to the University of Nebraska, but when you were teaching, you know, an assistant basketball coach at high school in Nebraska, did you just think, I'm just going to become a varsity coach somewhere and get a teaching job, and this is going to be my life?
Oh, no, no. I was the varsity coach now, Adrian. Let's not get that confused. That you know, went there because Nebraska needed teachers and coaches. I, you know, grew up in north of Chicago, right in between Chicago and Milwaukee, but had an opportunity to rattle to high school. That's why I went there, because I could become a head coach right away. And but, yeah, that career path thing, you know, yeah, we all get asked those kind of things. And for me, it's like the ultimate of not like what you know, but who you know. You know, growing up in Zion, you know, one of my very, very best friends, if not my best friend, Billy McKinney, was 1 year behind me. Ended up going to Northwestern, had a great career there, played in the NBA. Billy moves in the front office with the Bulls, and he gets hired by the Minnesota Timberwolves as a general manager, and he hires me from college to the NBA. And without Billy, there's no way I'd be sitting here right now. And the same thing happened, my opportunity to go from high school to college, and then, you know, I get the good fortune to go to Detroit and end up having a chance to be an assistant coach when Joe's playing. Get to know Joe. Joe takes over in the front office, end up working with him. The success that we have in Detroit that we've been talking about obviously propelled the opportunity to become a GM with the Bucks.
Zion, Illinois, there are two players. I don't know Zion's basketball history, if there's been a lot of great players since then or before, but there was a time where you and Billy McKinney were two of the best players in the state. You said Billy went on to Northwestern. He played pro ball. And I know you're modest about this, but you were getting recruited pretty heavily as a high school junior. There was a night that changed your life. You borrowed a motorcycle, right, from somebody, or you had a motorcycle.
It was my friend's.
What happened?
Yeah. Well, and look, we got to be really honest here, too. I was not recruited like that. I was not that level player. Billy was, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, could I have played maybe some kind of maybe Division II basketball? That was probably who I was in reality. Billy, a completely different story. But now, I had a great father, you know, who used to say to me, he would never say, like, you can't or, you know, don't. He would just, you know, ask the question of, like, you know, do you want to play? And I would say, of course. And he meant, like, you know, basketball. And my buddy had this little Honda 125 that I really liked to kind of, like, mess around on. And he said, I'd stay off that bike if I were you. That's what he told. That's what he handled me. And they were out of town. My buddy came over. Did nothing. As a matter of fact, I went over to a playground where guys were playing. Probably should have been playing that night because we played most every night, every single night. And, as a matter of fact, Billy was playing and Billy would tell you the story. Watched the guys play. He jumped on the back of the bike with me. I gave him a ride home to his house and probably, I don't know, maybe 5-6 blocks from his house. I'm going down the street. Lady hits me on the bike and hits me on the motorcycle. And, you know, I was really severely injured. And I mean, the fact that I'm standing here today is just a blessing and being able to walk the way I can. I had a, you know, major compound fractures in both bones, my tibia and the fibula. And so I missed my senior year of basketball and turned out to be a life changer for me though that, you know, all these things like, I mean, Adrian, for me, you know, these are all pinch me moments, you know, to think like, you know, sitting here as a general manager of an NBA team, I know how lucky and fortunate I am to be doing this. And, you know, like I think back like how and why. And I always think like, man, even like that, you know, if that wouldn't have happened, would I be sitting here today? And I'm not sure that I would have.
You had a friend that you grew up with, Scott Burgess, in Zion, and you went off to Greenville College, which is a small Christian school about maybe an hour from home. And you two went off to school together and you were both going to play ball there. You knew his family well. I think he had a family connection to that school. And you talk about seminal moments. You're in practice one day with Scott and you saw something happen that if you're in gyms your whole life, you see happen, maybe not every day, but all the time, a collision and everybody gets up. And there was a collision with Scott on the court and he did not get up.
So, yeah, Scott's mom, Mr. Burgess, had married Shay, now Shay Burgess, and she had worked at Greenville, and her brother was a professor there. And at one point, I can remember like one of their very first dates, she turns around to Scott and I in the car and says, are you guys thinking about college? And we said yes, and she goes, you should think about Greenville. And at that time, I'll tell you, I was playing. I had such a love and passion for the game. I think I was good enough. I could have played better than Greenville. And that's the first thing I thought. I ain't thinking about Greenville College. I'm thinking about something a lot bigger and better than that. And then the accident occurs. Scott says, hey, I'm going to go to Greenville. And really, Scott Burgess, Billy McKinney, and I, we were really close to three of us. And so, yeah, we went together. And Scott has the, you know, as I said, I've been in this game my whole life, and I've seen it happen over and over and over again. Guys just, you know, have the collision. They go down. And you're right, Scott didn't get up. His brain swelled. I stayed with him in the hospital the first night. His brain swelled and they rushed him to St. Louis, which was about an hour away. I was about 5 hours away from my home. It was downstate. They rushed him to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. He had brain surgery twice and died. So that's the way I started my, you know, I think about that. Here's a young kid, had just turned 18 years old, and I go back to my college dorm and the bed's empty. One of my best friends, one of my lifetime friends is gone. And so, but, you know, it's interesting. I've had a chance to work at universities, and I've never had a chance to work at a small college, but I always say that the amazing thing, I think I could really recruit to a small college, could have recruited to a small college, because the amazing thing about being in a place like that was that I always say, like, how that entire small college campus took me under their wing. It was amazing, Adrian, that I think this, had that occurred at, you know, a state school, Northern, Western, Eastern, something like that. Had that occurred there, I mean, I could see it like being in the school paper and people kind of talking about it, maybe a few like immediate friends saying, oh, well, sorry that happened. But like, you know, within the next week, it's gone and no one's thinking about it. At a small school like that, I can remember walking out almost every morning for the next probably year at least of people saying, seeing me, upperclassmen, hey, John, how you doing? I'm good. They would stop me. How you doing? How you really doing? And the same thing happened with professors, with administrators. So that small college that just literally took me under their wing and helped me get through that time. And, you know, it was really critical in my life.
Scott's parents, Jay and Shay Burgess, they lose a son and your parents pass away relatively close to each other, right?
Yes.
And you almost literally adopted each other. You almost, think, adopted them as your parents, your second parents. And they adopted you as a second son, and you've probably, it's a relationship that I know exists as strong as ever today.
Oh yeah, no doubt. You know, they have been everything to me and to my wife, and most importantly to my daughter. You know, my daughter is Lauren Shay Hammond. named after Grandma Shea. And they have been there. It's, you know, everything that my daughter's been through in her life. I mean, from the three-year-old little dance recitals to graduating from high school to graduate from college to everything that she's done in her life, they've been there for her. And so they've been, you know, so important to us in our lives.
They came to you, I guess, maybe there was actually a conversation where they said, like, hey, we really want you to stay a part of our lives. And they were maybe even a little sheepish when they asked you about it, but I think you felt the same way they did. You remember, was there a moment sort of in the aftermath of losing Scott where they said, hey, we don't want to grow apart from you. We want to keep you a part of our lives.
There was that, but yeah. There was just that natural fit too. The fact that I felt like they kind of needed me a little bit, and I can tell you, I needed them a lot more than they needed me. And the fact, like you said, when I lost both of my parents shortly thereafter, and the timing was just perfect for all of us to be apart and become one, and it's been a special relationship and still is today.
And it's not like, hey, we send Christmas cards or we get on the phone a couple times a year. They're with you at Christmas. They come by around Christmas whenever you and your wife have moved to a new job. They sort of had a tradition of showing up, and whether it was helping you move in, but they come and spend time with you.
Everything. I mean, it is everything in our lives. You know, they've everywhere I've been, they've been. You're right. Like my wife just said the other night, you know, like Grandma Shea is all over this house. She's got a great knack for like interior decorating and so she's just, they're all over our house and all over our families.
And I think, and the people who know you in the NBA, I think it carries over to your professional life that I think relationships have always been real important to you at different points in your life. And we've talked about, but I think the one thing people, whether it's other executives or agents or coaches you've been around, is that so much of this profession is relationships and being able, and it helps you sometimes to make a deal you want to make. It helps you to get information you need to make a decision. And I think with you, I think that's just part of who you are, of like, if I'm going to take this journey, if I'm going to be in this life, I like the people. I want to be around it. I just think it seems like that some of those early experiences kind of became a hallmark of how you've done your job.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's probably a lot of truth to that, Adrian. For me, most everything I do is relationship driven. And, you know, it's been so great over my life, the relationships that I have, but also in this business, you know, my time in the NBA, the relationships that I have with people that I've worked with and from friends in the media to people like agents, you know, people say, talk about an agent, I'll say, he's a friend of mine. And I think people look at me and say, like, he can't be your friend. They're the enemy. And, you know, I don't live that way. I don't operate that way. And I don't think it's healthy to be that way.
John, in this job, like, you've so much of being a GM, and it's probably, I think it's always been true, but listen, there's very few who just, hey, it's just a unilateral, it's my vision, it's my decision. Almost everything in every organization is pretty cooperative, whether it's ownership, coaching. Herb Kohl hired you as his GM, and you were executive of the year 2010 when Herb was your owner. And then team got sold, Mark Lazary and Wes Edens. And you had Larry Drew as your coach, and they make a decision to bring in Jason Kidd, who they had a relationship with. So here comes Jason, and now, okay, the owners didn't hire me, and I didn't hire the coach, but I'm the GM. And I've got to make this work. I've got to find a way now to exist in a new reality. How do you do it? How did you do it? How have you – because they could have – listen, if it wasn't working, they could have just said, John, we're bringing in our own guy. You're out. They didn't. They gave you an extension. You went forward with this group, and you found a way to make it work. How'd you go about it, and how do you learn to handle that new reality as an executive to adjust to a very different set of circumstances?
You know, I think I was fortunate when it happened in my career that, you know, you always talk about like trying to figure out who and what you are. And I have accepted like how fortunate I am to have the opportunity that I have to be in a position like this and work as an NBA general manager. And so when something like that happens, you know, two things. Number one is like, you know, you say, okay, how are you going to react? And for me, it really wasn't that difficult because my ego doesn't get in my way in a time like that. And I don't like, you know, start fighting myself with this inner battle of like, well, hey, I don't make it all about me. It's not about me. It's about them, you know, Mark and Wes as owners of the team and the decision they make, and then Jason coming in as coach. And, like, I look and evaluate the situation and say, can I work in this? And, of course, I can. I mean, I think I can work in most any situation. I really do. I mean, I've done it. I've done everything in this league you can do with the exception of being a head coach. And so I feel like my ability to work with people is one of my greatest strengths. And you know, also another part, Adrian, you know, the fact that I've, you know, had some experiences of, you know, I told you in Detroit, we went through some coaches. I know how things happen sometimes. I know how hires occur. And so, you know, when something like this happens, my experience also a lot, then, you know, if I hadn't been through it, I mean, I might be thinking to myself, like, how could this happen? This is right or this is wrong or whatever it might be. And look, I simply like thought back at some of the experiences I've had and said, I understand. And now I have to find a way to fit in to make this work.
And you said it there, like that you weren't going to let the ego get in the way. And we've seen plenty of cases in this league, really good executives, really good basketball people. It becomes a battle of wills. It becomes egos and someone's going to have to go and guys implode. And we've had conversations with many of them in any walk of life where they look back and said, geez, I wish I made that work. I had a great thing. And as you said, there's only 30 of these jobs that you sort of, to me, it's as important of a trait as anything you have to have in this job because, you know, there's a couple executives in the league that are bigger than life, bigger than the franchise. Pat Riley sort of is the Miami Heat and, you know, what they built over a long time in San Antonio. You know, Pop can make decisions and, but everyone else is really at the mercy of the circumstances and the environment that, you know, you can either talk your way or yell or scream or react your way right out of that league and maybe never get back into it.
That's so true, Adrian. You know, as we're having this discussion, I can remember when I was coaching with the Clippers and Larry Brown was the head coach and Larry left and went to Indiana. And I stayed on for the next few months there and then, you know, talk about Billy McKinney and bringing me into the league. Not only did he bring me into the league, he brought me to Detroit. Billy then became the general manager of the Detroit Pistons. And I'm with the Clippers as an assistant coach and Billy's with Detroit and he says, hey, look, if you want to come work with me in Detroit, you can do that. And I remember, think about a guy like Elgin Baylor and the magnitude of who he was in this league. And I had 3 years. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed my time with Elgin. Jeff Weltman and I used to go sit in Elgin's office for hours and listen to tell stories. And what a neat, neat guy. But anyway, I remember Elgin saying to me, I said, Elgin, I think I'm going to leave. I'm going to go to Detroit and I'm going to work as a scout in the front office. And I remember Elgin saying to me, he said, John, what do you want to do? Do you want to coach in this league or do you want to work in the front office? And, you know, at that time, I remember I paused for a second and I looked at him and who he is. And I thought to myself, I'm not that. I'm never going to be who he is. And, you know, I said to him, I said, you know, Elge, I can't choose. You know, for me, I've got to go where the opportunity is. And so that's kind of still who I am in this league. And I'm the majority. I'm not the minority here. Right. Like you just said, there's only a couple guys that have that kind of power in this league. And for the most of us, it's, you know, we're thankful for the opportunities and appreciate the chances that we have to work in this league.
The idea of being a GM in this league now, how much more is there to manage? Like you and I were talking about this earlier before we came on about managing the health side of players now, the workloads and the data that you take to try to keep players healthier, to try to manage as best you can injuries and wear and tear on players and having an analytics department. And listen, when you sat there with Elgin Baylor and Jeff Weltman and with the Clippers, now Donald wouldn't have paid for it anyway. Donald Sterling wouldn't have paid for the technology anyway if it was there. But you were also with other organizations where those weren't considerations. The things you deal with day in and day out in 2017 now, how dramatically different than even when you and Joe Dumars are doing it in Detroit? How much more is there to manage now?
Well, you know, every situation is different for every GM, the amount that you do have to manage. But I think overall, I think in general that, you know, the fact that you're just bringing up, just look at the size of staffs and how much they've grown. You know, I remember when I got the GM's job in Milwaukee. I got a call from Brendan Malone. one of the best, you know, Brendan was the head coach of the Toronto Raptors at that time. And Brendan, in his Brendan ways, said, you know, John, I'm happy for you. You know, great that, you know, and you deserve it, yada, yada. I said all the nice things, and I appreciate that. And he said, one thing I've realized as the head coach, he said, you know, when I was an assistant coach, he goes, I was very, very concerned about the job I did, and I wanted to do my very best as an assistant coach. And he said, and then when I became the head coach of the Raptors, he goes, I realized then that I was not only concerned about the job I was doing as the head coach, but I also had to be concerned about the rest of my coaching staff. And he said, now, John, you're the GM. And he said, as a GM, you've got to be concerned about the job you're doing, which I know you're going to do because you're going to be self-conscious like I am about our work. And he said, but also you got to be concerned about the guys on your staff. You got to be concerned about the head coach. You got to be concerned about all the assistants, the equipment manager, on down. And, but I also remember Brendan said at the end of that call, he said, but you know, John, he said, every day, look yourself in the mirror and say, you know what? I'm the general manager of the Milwaukee Bucks. And I got to tell you, there it's some difficult times have occurred, like for any of us in these jobs. And there have been times, usually my wife doesn't hear me. I'm usually doing like maybe in a hotel room by myself, but I've done it. I've looked in the mirror and I've said out loud, I'm the general manager of the Milwaukee Bucks, thinking about Brendan. And don't forget, you know, like how fortunate you are to have the job. But with that being said, too, you think about that and the size of sales. So if Brendan is right and we're saying our responsibility is all of those, think about the size of staff. Think about the size of if your concern is the coaching staff, you know, now instead of like two assistants or three assistants, every staff has four, five, six assistants. Look at the medical staffs and look what we've done. I can tell you internally, you know, new ownership has allowed us to grow. We hired a gentleman from the U.S. ski team, Troy Flanagan, to oversee our medical team, and our staff is growing. You know, we've gone from a staff of, you know, maybe two people on the medical side to probably six people on the medical side and strength conditioning and nutritionists, chefs, everything that we're doing, like every other, staff. But say all that, I guess to say that, you know, you're right with this job. If you're saying as a GM, kind of all that is under your umbrella, it's a big undertaking and a big responsibility.
When they came to you, John, and said, hey, we want you to help groom your successor. And we're going to make you part of the search to hire that person. I guess I would imagine you, appreciated the fact that you were part of it. They just didn't say, here's a guy who's going to be here. He's taken over in a few years. Work with him. Deal with it. You were part of the process with Justin Zanuck, who had come from the Jazz. You knew Justin as an agent for years when he worked with Andy Miller at ASM. What was that process like, and how did you, I don't know, how do you come to terms with that? Okay, like, what do I want in a guy? How are we going to make this work over the next few years? Because it was a unique circumstance.
Yeah, once again, it's not about me. It's about them, and it's about what they think is right. And, you know, so look, I can only say this, that Wes Edens, Mark Lasry, and Jamie Dimon have been so kind and gracious to me with now my time with them since they've owned the team. And I couldn't ask for anything more. You know, they treat you with respect. They allow you to do your job. And that was just a kind of a part of the process that we've gone through. But they have been so good and kind to me, I couldn't ask for anything more.
For you now to be a part of a Bucks organization where you've got the new arena coming, you've got these young cornerstone players. Listen, it's a lot different than, hey, when you walk in, it's the old Bradley Center, and that's your reality, and your practice facility is a unique one. It's like, you know, it's a Catholic school. You think you're pulling into, well, you're, you know, St. Francis. It doesn't, like, some of these facilities are space age, right? Like Jeff Weltman, what they have in Toronto. Like, I remember I went in there and Masai and Jeff were showing me that war room, and it's like video boards. And I'm like, are you drafting a player in here? Or are you guys launching a satellite, right? Like, but the Bucks are still like, it's an old, you know, you're on the water there. Well, you're near the water there. Yeah. But it's like a combination, school and the old arena. Now all of a sudden here comes this new arena and, you know, the practice facility. Like it's quite a transformation to be a part of, I would imagine.
You know, we talk about like organizations and good luck, success, things that happen, putting the team together. All that being said, hey, we also all know this. It all starts at the top. And you look with Wes and Mark and Jamie and what they have done since they purchased this team and bought this team, and it's all, it, I'm telling you, when I say it's about them, it really is all about them, that, you know, we're building we're going to be in a new practice center, 1 year from now. We're going to be in a new arena 2 years from now, two seasons from now, and now a season and a half, and this, all the things that they're, you know, getting a D-League team, which we've needed, you know, so everything that we need as an organization to be successful, you know, to kind of the old theory of keeping up with the Joneses, they're doing it all.
There became an arms race. Always people talk about the arms race in college sports. There became an arms race in the NBA of facilities and staff that sort of mirrors what you talked about in recruiting in college.
No doubt whatsoever. That's exactly what it is. There is that arms race, so to speak, and that they're giving, I think, us as an organization, every chance to be successful. And, you know, look, I think it's just a fun time. That's a fun time right now. Hey, look, it's because, you know, you talk about like that hope factor, and I think there is that hope. I think people can see it. They can feel it with the young players on our roster. You know, we have Chris Middleton hopefully to rejoin our team here, you know, at some point in the season yet. And then you even see more of that hope, you know, that I think people look at the roster and see, man, wow, what if they become, we can become, and then the new practice facility, the new arena, a lot of positive things happening. You know, I can tell you on the business side, Peter Fagan, team president, is doing an amazing job there with his leadership and the growth and the vision that's on that side. So a lot of positive things happening with the Milwaukee Bucks.
John, I appreciate you taking the time to swing through here on your trip through New York, and I know we'll catch up with you soon here this season.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. A big thank you to our guest today, Milwaukee Bucks GM John Hammond. Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to the podcast. And be sure to subscribe to the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. You can find us on thevertical.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher. And you can now hear the Vertical Podcast Network every weekday at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. We'd also like to take a moment to thank today's sponsors, SeatGeek and Blue Apron. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. We'll catch you next time.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.